Thanks for having me here. My name is Tony. I'm a primary care sports medicine doc up in Kingwood, which is about an hour away from here. My talk today is going to be on the environmental concerns of the athlete, and the objectives are to explore how the body changes in extreme heat and cold, the physiologic changes that the body goes through to compensate for the changes in temperature, preventing serious complications from heat, exertional heat stroke, and also cold hypothermia. We're going to go through the latest guidelines and recommendations. And so my first topic is going to be heat. It is June, and this is Houston, so it is hot outside. And the physiological responses to heat that the athlete goes through include vasodilation. So the skin blood vessels get larger, more blood goes through it, and the body loses heat through that radiation and convection. Increased sweat during this time as well. And so the body likes to be between 96 and 98 degrees Fahrenheit. And if anything were to bump it up, bump up the temperature or lower the temperature, the brain goes into a set protocol telling the body what to do to dump excess heat or actually increase the heat production that it has. And heat illness is actually a combination of about 5 or 6 different entities. And so for minor heat illness, you can see cramping, the edema, flushing, and occasionally more serious types, you can actually have fainting, syncope, and then the exertional heat stroke, which I'll talk about a little bit later. And the risk factors for heat illness. The number one risk factor that's been shown in studies is the sport that you play. And the number one sport is football. And football starts in August, September, when people put on pads and they go out in 90-degree heat and run around and hit each other. Other risk factors are obesity. And so the bigger the lineman and also the more massive athletes, they have an increased risk for heat illness because their fat and even muscle kind of tends to insulate themselves. And so smaller athletes have an advantage in this regard. The outside temperature, the hotter it is, it makes sense that the more likely that you'll have a heat illness. But it's not exactly just the temperature that you see on the outside, the weather report. And so I'm going to go through the wet bulb globe index a little bit later as well. The humidity plays a huge role in this as well. Also, the risks of medical conditions. Anytime someone has a fever, they're automatically at risk for thermal dysregulation because their body is already not set at the proper 96 to 98 degrees. Also, certain medications, such as diuretics, tend to dehydrate the athlete. Sometimes the athletes will also be on ADHD medications, and those will also dehydrate the athlete and putting them at risk for heat illness. The symptoms, I briefly went through them before. Initially, it's going to be cramps, and you're going to see a lot of cramps in the very first couple weeks of football, couple weeks of certain activities, because the athletes are not, they're not used to that kind of activity. Fatigue, and more seriously, the altered mental status. And you probably heard about this guy at some point. He was a Minnesota Pro Bowl offensive lineman. He died in 2001 in August during the first 1 or 2 days of conditioning camp. He came in a little bit overweight, had a collapse on the field. It wasn't handled properly at that time, and he ended up dying. The family settled with the NFL in 2009 for an undisclosed amount of money. And because of this, more research has been done for heat illness, and a institute is actually formed from the University of Connecticut. And that's where a lot of the data now today has been for heat illnesses. And I did want to mention the exertional heat stroke, and this is the medical emergency. It's one of the few medical emergencies that you can see on the sidelines. There's been 31 recorded high school deaths between 1995 and 2009, and 2009 is the last year that they've actually kept done studies. And so the new numbers will be published a little bit soon. And exertional heat stroke is when the body pretty much doesn't, it can't keep its temperature at the set amount anymore. And so everything that's going on outside the body kind of pushes it over the edge, and you go into a spiral of hyperthermia. And it's diagnosed through a couple of things. One is the temperature, which is 40.5, and that's going to be about 105 degrees Celsius, or 105 degrees Fahrenheit, sorry, and altered mental status. And so when you see people going through exertional heat stroke, they're completely confused. They don't know who you are. They don't know where they are. And it's very critical to see and capture those people quickly. One of the recommendations is a rectal thermometer, and it's been shown in studies that the axillary thermometers, the temporal scan thermometers can be low, falsely low in these people. And so rectal thermometers are ideal for this. The treatment for this, as Jean-Claude Van Damme is showing to you guys, is immersion in cold. And so ice water bath all the way up until the shoulders or neck area. And that has to be done as soon as possible. For milder cases, rest, rehydration will work as well. They have cold IV fluids available in the EMS, but the guidelines say that the EMS is not the right choice for initial treatment for this because they don't have the tools available for them to really cool down an athlete. And the target temperature is going to be 102.8 degrees Fahrenheit. And after they've been cooled to this target, just continually monitor them and get them outside of the ice bath. Because when you dip the temperature too low, the body starts to say, oh, I need to heat up again. And you actually don't want that. And so the National Athletic Trainer Association in 2015 gave updated guidelines. The original guideline was back in 2002, about a year after Corey Stringer's death. And the main thing in this guideline is to have a plan, to know what to do, to recognize when something is an emergency. And the other big thing is to educate your athletes, coaches, and parents as well, because your eyes can't be everywhere on the field. If everybody kind of knows what to look for, it may help identify some bad situations a little bit earlier. The other, actually probably most important thing is how to prevent this. And the one thing that they talked about the most is acclimatization. And it's actually important for heat, cold, and also altitude, as I'll talk about in the future. And this is basically ramping up activity between 1 to 2 weeks before, ideally 2 weeks before their regular football training, basketball training, soccer training, and going through little by little, increasing their activity at this certain temperature. And it's been shown that if you do that for the next 2 or 3 weeks, they'll be much more likely to tolerate that temperature and tolerate that condition much better. And the other thing, lastly, it's modifications of activity for wet bulb globe temperature, and I'll go through that in the future. The wet bulb globe temperature is a formula. It's taking into account three different methods of obtaining temperature. One is the wet bulb, the other is dry air, and then the last one is going to be the radiation from the sun. There is an activity modification guidelines for this, and there are black flag conditions, and so the main point is over 90, if it's 90 degrees wet bulb globe temperature, it's a black flag. There should be no practices for games at that point. And that's actually a very high temperature. 90 doesn't seem like a lot, but when you take into account the wet bulb globe temperature being 90, that's actually pretty significant. Continuous exercise conditions above 82 should be canceled, and that means the marathons, long-distance runs, any time when the body just has to go through a sustained amount of activity without any possibility for rest. And if they're doing football practice, you know, they can rest sometimes, and there's guidelines for that too. But if the athlete is non-acclimated, the target is above 86, where you should be decreasing their activity. And this is from the Corey Stringer Institute. It just goes through the heat category, wet bulb, low temperature, and the black flag, red flag conditions that people kind of talk about. It did give one example for football. So the first 2 days, football in this heat outside, you can go non-contact with just the helmet because all the pads, increase activity will always increase the athlete's temperature. And then the day 3 to 4, gradually more pads on, still no contact. And then after 5 through 14 days, or the end of the week, something similar to what they're doing in full practice. And so what does this do, the acclimatization? If you're from a cold weather area and you come here and you want to run outside, you'll probably find it a little bit difficult. But after a couple weeks of running outside gradually, your body will go through a lot of these changes. One of the changes is it actually ramps up the fluid volume that you have. It changes your kidneys. It also changes how much you sweat, what your sweat content is, so less salt in your sweat, and also the decreased threshold for initiating that sweat. So you'll actually sweat more, but it's a mechanism that helps you in these hot conditions. The other things that acclimatization does is decrease your heart rate for the equivalent exertion, so you're not going to be expending as much energy, and that is it for heat. So for cold, we don't deal with that too much here. Occasionally we do see it in the marathon runners and also the Ironman runners. I've been exercising for, 5 to 15 hours. The body kind of runs out of fuel to heat itself. And so even in the last Ironman race, it was held in late April, there were a lot of hypothermia incidences in the medical tent. And so the physiologic response to cold is the exact opposite. So vasoconstriction, your blood vessels in the outside close up, so you lose less heat to the surrounding atmosphere, less blood flow to the skin, you start shivering, and your muscles start involuntarily contracting, which we probably all felt at some point. You increase the metabolism, increase a lot of the pathways, increase your calorie burning during that time. The risks of this are thinner body types, people who are outside for long periods of time. So it's going to be the marathon runners, cross-country runners, people who don't wear that much in terms of padding. A lot of the football players have that multi-layered pads and other equipment on. But the cross-country runners really, you can't do that. It's just going to decrease your time and your ability to run. And also the same thing goes with an outside factor. So wind is a big factor in the wind chill. Everybody's heard of it's a huge deal. It can make things much worse at a certain same temperature. So mild hypothermia, 32 to 35 degrees. I think most people here use degrees Fahrenheit. So 90 to 95 would be mild. Moderate is going to be below 90 and above 82. And then hopefully no one sees a severe one, but less than 28 degrees Celsius, less than 82. The symptoms of cold injury, cold illnesses, shivering. The body has a natural tendency to shiver starting at about 95, 94 degrees Fahrenheit. But that shivering actually stops at 88, so it's a sign if someone's not shivering and they're really cold, they're probably not doing too well and it's a very low temperature. You actually increase urine production. Your confusion rate starts pretty early, around 93, 94. Muscle stiffness, and then eventually muscle contractions, loss of consciousness, altered mental status, and this, you can actually have some bleeding, so disseminated intravascular coagulation. The platelets generally don't want to be below 93, 94, and they don't work, as do a lot of proteins outside their given temperature. The heart rate changes. You're initially going to be tachycardic, and then when it gets really bad, you get bradycardic. And there's some EKG, interesting EKG findings, but we won't go through them at this time. And so this is a picture of frostbite. A very early frostbite. You can see the edema and also the vesicles popping up. Eventually those, if they continue to be exposed to cold, those fingers are going to turn black and fall off. So the treatment for this, for mild cases, 90 to 95 degrees. Passive rewarming, just get them in, give them a blanket, take off their wet clothes, and let them kind of, they say in the text, shiver themselves back to normalcy. After 90 degrees, when people stop shivering, then typically the answer is going to be active warming, so active heating pads, those sorts of things. You can also give them IV fluids, with warmed IV fluids. The treatment and the the treatment for severe cases are going to be sometimes peritoneal dialysis, it's a lot of crazy stuff. Basic life support for these situations, airway, breathing, circulation, and acclimatization. So you can see here, this kid is obviously not bothered by freezing cold temperatures and he's in shorts. The next topic is going to be lightning. Occasionally lightning will delay games. I'm sure you've all kind of seen it before. Lightning strikes are rare, but they are serious, so we pay pretty big attention to this. 70% of the lightning strikes are intra-cloud and they don't hit the ground, 30% hit the ground. And of all the lightning strikes that have been documented, most of them, 90-95% of them, are not direct hits. And so they will hit an area like the ground right next to me. But if they hit the ground, you're going to feel it too. And there's been a lot of videos on that, especially in soccer events when that kind of happens. And you see multiple people just fall into the ground. Lightning can definitely cause a lot of cardiac issues. The heart is muscle as well as an electrical system. And so it doesn't like being shocked out of nowhere. The National Athletic Trainers Association has a statement of this as well. They've done studies showing that 15% of lightning fatalities occur during sporting events. And that makes sense because most of the time when there's lightning and rain around, people aren't outside in a group huddled together. There's been 4 deaths per year over the last couple of decades. There's a 30-minute recommended delay minimum of activity. The National Weather Service has tons of tracking systems and there's tons of apps out there as well. Most of the time there's one person just completely dedicated to looking at the weather, seeing what's going on out there. In large venues, it's always good to have a plan as well. Know where to send the athletes, know where to send the crowd, find and have really safe shelter places. And most of the time, that's going to be indoors. This is the tracking for lightning strikes about a couple days ago. I just looked that up randomly, and you can see that Wyoming was hit, Wisconsin was hit, and there were some lightning strikes off the coast. So it's very cool nowadays. You can see exactly where things are going real time with a lot of these apps. The old school method of tracking where or how far away lightning is the flash, the bang, and so it's 30 seconds. The speed of sound is approximately 1,000 feet per second, it's a little bit more, and so 5 seconds of it is approximately a mile away, and so it's a 6-mile radius. But nowadays we can pinpoint it very accurately. And anytime there's a strike within a 6-mile radius, play basically just stops. The treatment for it, resuscitation. A lot of times people think that the people or athletes who are hit by lightning have a residual charge, but that's not correct. The charge dissipates in a couple of milliseconds. So it's okay to touch the patient. I just say that here because a lot of times people still have that misconception. Fluids, AED, CPR, and if it's a direct hit, there's the likelihood of survival is actually pretty low. It's just going to be CPR, AED, and C. Hopefully they'll survive. And in addition to heat, cold, and lightning, there's altitude. And Houston's pretty flat, but there's certain areas around the country, especially Denver, most famously the Mile High City. It's going to be a big deal to go there and to play a sport. If any of your teams ever travel to one of these places that are kind of high up, that may be an issue. I was also looking at some of the other notable cities, and there's Mexico City, I didn't know, is about 7,500 feet above sea level. So it must be hard for the United States national team when they go there and play a friendly. They've got to get acclimated to it. And Bogota as well, that's the highest city that's also considered large, or more than 2 million people. It's 8,500 feet above sea level. Acute mountain sickness, when you go to a higher altitude, the amount of oxygen in the air is not the same, and it's not what you're used to. And so your body is not able to pull that oxygen in, and that causes a lot of different difficult issues. It would make sense that your athletic ability is going to be definitely impaired. But even beyond that, just day-to-day activities may be impaired as well, especially if your brain is not able to get enough oxygen, which can occasionally happen. The most serious serious things that can happen from this are high-altitude pulmonary edema and high-altitude cerebral edema. It's just two things to watch out for medical emergencies. Symptoms, high-altitude sickness, is going to be shortness of breath. There's going to be fatigue, headaches, nausea, vomiting. And then, like the other two conditions, altered mental status. And that's your key to saying something is really wrong here. The prevention of this, one is not playing. Sometimes, a lot of athletes in the NFL do have sickle cell trait, and they opt not to play in Denver. And because they always run the risk there for one of their sickle cell crises to happen, and that's not a good thing. The prevention for most of this is a slow ascent. So you don't want to go there day one, and then day two you play your game, or you hike, or whatever you're doing in the mountains. The best thing for you to do is to go up slowly, maybe halfway, three-fourths of the way, get acclimated to that area, and then go up a couple of days later. There are certain medications here that help with this, but they don't really prevent this from happening. One is acetazolamide, nifedipine, and then interestingly, Viagra is used for this as well. So you can get it covered by your insurance. The treatment for this, rapid descent, you have to get basically lower the altitude down the mountain as fast as you can. Oxygen supplementation helps temporarily as well while you're going through it. All right, so in conclusion, there's a lot of different types of weather patterns out there, different climates that athletes participate in. Know the serious things that can happen to each one, how to prevent them, early diagnosis, and for heat, cold, and altitude, it's basically acclimatization. Human beings are very, very resourceful and resilient. They live everywhere, so if you get used to that area, it will be less of a problem.